Welcome. You are listening to Copland. Copland is about the life and times of our protectors and defenders, police, fire, EMS, medical trauma units, and the military. The underappreciated doing the unthinkable for the often ungrateful. I am Jay Dobbins, and I'll be your host. In each season, we will hear three episodes featuring extraordinary heroes, amazing personal experiences that will inspire and uplift you. Sometimes they might shock you. The highs and lows, the successes and the failures, told in their own words and all experienced during their personal journey of sacrifice to make the world a safer place. This is Copland. Very few have ever dented the universe and made their lives valuable to others like Dr. Richard Carmona. He is a national treasure. His resume would be unbelievable if it were not true. High school dropout, joins the Army, gets his GED, becomes a paratrooper, a special forces medic seeing combat in Vietnam. Post-military, he graduates at the top of his class at the nation's premier medical school, becomes an internationally recognized trauma surgeon, then co-duties that as a sheriff's deputy, SWAT team leader, tactics instructor, search and rescue expert, is involved in multiple combat shootings, himself shot in the line of duty on more than one occasion, and then is named President Bush's Surgeon General of the United States, the only Surgeon General in history to receive a unanimous and bipartisan Senate confirmation. On a personal note, he has been a guide, a mentor, and most importantly, a friend after leading the trauma team that saved my life over 30 years ago. When you have a resume like Dr. Carmona's, even the President of the United States is allowed to poke fun at you.
The great President of the United States of America, George W. Bush.
Thank you, please. Thank you all. Thank you very much. Thank you. Please sit down. Welcome to the White House. Since 1871, the Surgeon General has been America's chief health educator, giving Americans the best, most up-to-date knowledge on how to improve their health and reduce the risk of disease. When I first learned that Richard Carmona once dangled out of a moving helicopter, I worried that maybe he wasn't the best guy to educate our Americans about reducing health risks.
Dr. Carmona's story is the type Hollywood movies are made of, beginning in a most unusual way, as a kid, without direction, growing up in Harlem, New York.
I was oldest of four. My parents spoke Spanish as a first language, and my generation was the first to learn English. We grew up in Harlem, which was a poor area. There wasn't much discrimination there because it was mostly brown and black people. But you learn about discrimination early when you venture outside because of your skin color, you're brown or black. And so, you know, you learn the hard lessons of being characterized a certain way by your skin color, which is painful as a child. But, you know, did pretty well. The block I grew up on, as I said, I didn't know anybody who graduated from high school. Most everybody was living day to day. Most people were living paycheck to paycheck, if there was a paycheck. We never had a phone. Actually, we had a phone for a few months, but they couldn't pay it. I still remember the number, which is ironic, but we didn't have a phone for years. And the rent was really almost nothing. Didn't have a TV for a long time. Often in the winter, we'd sleep with our clothes on because there was no heat. And in the summer, lots of roaches and mice in the house and apartment. But we were happy kids. Parents weren't responsible for your extracurricular activity. We went out and played stickball. We played stoop ball. We swam in the river, in the Harlem River. And, you know, probably why I'm so healthy today, because I've been exposed to every pathogen known to mankind. But that's the way it was. We were happy kids. We were just poor, but we didn't know it as kids. We were just happy, you know. And but as I said, up until my teen years, when it became glaringly apparent that I'm going to have to do something, and no skills, no education, a truant, lots of potential, according to my mom, my grandma, my counselors in high school, but of course don't listen to them. And, you know, then the critical juncture for me, which is many times in my life where I was struggling, somebody always happened to come along and be a mentor and help me with some direction. And that was the case when I was 17, and I met this Special Forces officer who I got enamored with his uniform and his stories. And it wasn't bragging, but just telling me about the bigger world that I had never seen, and telling me what all of his badges meant on his uniform and where he had been and traveled and the schooling he had. And I was thinking, man, this is pretty cool. You know, he jumps out of planes and he does all these things and he scuba dives and you know, and that probably was the thing that inspired me. And in addition to him asking me a couple of questions over a couple of day period, the first day he was in uniform, then I saw him in the neighborhood a few times after and took a liking to me. And then he had asked me one day about people in the neighborhood, and he named this one guy Danny. He says, did you know Danny? I said, oh yeah. He said, is Danny still down in the park? I said, yeah. He said, on the bench in the corner, is he still dealing drugs? I said, how'd you know? He said, Danny was there when I was a kid. And he said, if you don't get out of here, you're going to take Danny's bench one day, if you're lucky. But he said, you may not make it that long. Because, you know, and he was right, because when I was downrange in Vietnam a couple of years later, my two best friends, one died swimming in the Harlem River high on drugs, and the other got shot in the head in a drug deal. And it was odd because I was in combat and I lost two buddies in the civilian world.
Dr. Carmona speaks of the value of mentors in our lives.
Throughout my life, whether it was my mother, my grandmother, this gentleman, my high school counselors, in the military, mentors that I had who were, you know, these iconic Special Forces guys who take you under their wing, you know, they've spent their whole career there. And they mold you. They teach you how to be a soldier and an operator. And then transitioning, you know, years later into other jobs as a lifeguard, when I was an ocean lifeguard, a guy who was my chief lifeguard, he's almost 80 years old today. He's still a lifeguard. He's a legend in the lifeguarding field, okay? And took me under his wing as well. And then I go through to medical school, same thing. Professors who saw something in me I didn't see myself. Actually, even before that, in junior college, a professor at Bronx Community who passed away, who was African-American guy, who was the head of the chemistry department, Gil Riley, who was also a veteran who had dropped out of high school, and bonded with him. And I aced the organic chemistry course because he was like a father to me. And Henry Hermo, who was my biology professor, took me under his wing. So again, along the road, I can think of all these people who mentored me, took a chance on me, saw opportunity to educate me and move me to the next level, which shows you no man is an island. You know, we all are attached to one another. So all of those experiences right up to in law enforcement as well. When I was doing SWAT, and I met John Coleman, who started the NTOA and was one of the first SWAT commanders in the United States at LA County, and took me under his wing and gave me some opportunities there. It's really amazing if you string out your life along this timeline and you think about it. When you're successful, there's always somebody there that gave you a kick in the butt, talked to you, worked with you, admonished you when you needed it, but somehow you became better after that experience. And that's part of my life. And I owe it to a lot of good people along the way, probably equally with my wife, who I told you I've let down a lot and could have been a better husband, missed a whole lot of stuff, but she was always there for me, no matter what. When I was down and out, hurt, shot, whatever it happened to be, injured, for better or worse, she was there all the time. And as I say to her, she doesn't want me to say that ever, I always say, you deserved better. Because we always used to joke, because she came from a police family, NYPD, and she always, you know, good Catholic girl, very well brought up, nice values. Her aspiration was eventually finish school, get married, have her kids, and live in the suburbs, and wanted a nice house with a white picket fence. She always used to joke about it. I don't want anything extravagant. I just want a nice house in the suburbs. I want to go to my kids' games, go to the PTA, raise a family, you know, go to church on Sunday. And then she got stuck with me. And so that joke was always there with the white picket fence. And all these things I did, the military, so you know, we moved 16, 17 times. And so I still don't see a white picket fence, you know. So that was always the joke. So you fast forward about 30 years later, we're walking into the White House for me to be nominated for Surgeon General. And as we're walking in, there's the fence around the White House. And she smacks me and she said, "I said white picket fence, not White House." So I've been very fortunate to be surrounded by some terrific people who saw in me more potential than I saw in myself and helped me appreciate that potential.
Dr. Carmona's life in public service began as a paratrooper.
So I went to basic training. I did pretty well. I mean, but most of the kids in my basic training group were young, 17, 18, 19-year-old kids like me, okay, who had minimal education, maybe a high school, and were all destined to go to Vietnam, many of whom would die in Vietnam. But once I finished basic and then AIT, they trained you to be an infantryman or a rifleman, and you're the guys who carry the weapons and do the fighting. And then I volunteered for jump school and went to jump school. And that was a rude awakening too, because there are no excuses there. It's a punishing 3 weeks in Fort Benning, Georgia, in July, with the temperatures 100 degrees and the humidity like that, and guys are dropping left and right. And they don't care. You get up, you do your push-ups, you do your pull-ups, as they used to tell you, push Georgia, because you're going to be pushing it for 3 weeks. Or pull up Georgia. And 3 weeks later, you make your five jumps in jump week, and now you're a paratrooper. And if you don't have other orders, at that point, you're almost always heading to Vietnam. But I raised my hand again, and the Special Forces recruiter was there. So I took my tests, I did well, and, you know, they figure that if you can make it through jump school, that was kind of a unofficial test that you'd be able to make the runs and the physical activity for Special Forces training. When I got to start Special Forces training, then it was pointed out to me, "Son, we just saw you're not a high school graduate." And I was already a couple of months into training. I said, "Well, no, sir, I'm not." And actually, I said, "No, sergeant," because the NCOs don't want you calling them sir, because they believe it's beneath their dignity as a non-commissioned officer. And I said, "What do I need to do?" He said, "You need to get a high school diploma." So I went to the education office, and they said, "Well, you can take a course." I said, "Can I take the test?" They said, "You can, but have you been in school recently?" I said, "No, not for a while, but I'd like to take the test." So you had the option not to take a course and take the GED. I took the test and I did pretty well. So I got my high school diploma, stayed in Special Forces, trained as a Special Forces weapons specialist and a medical specialist, which is the longest training. It's over a year. So we fast forward a year and a half later. I graduate. I get my Green Beret, earned my Green Beret. 130-something of us started out that were selected, and 30 of us graduated. And interesting, this last June in Fort Bliss, Texas, my class had its 50th anniversary. 15 of us still standing, all combat veterans, all showed up. And it was some of them I hadn't seen in years, and it was like we were getting together like it was yesterday, because of being battle buddies, so to speak. And after that, you know, my time in Special Forces, things changed, went combat, you know, got wounded, lost a lot of buddies, matured very quickly. Combat has a way of doing that for you. But learning critical skills that are essential to you being successful in life. You start to think of every single thing you do as a mission. What are my resources? What are my deliverables? Who's my chain of command? Who do I report to? Who's going to judge my mission? Who's going to give me my assignment? And, you know, this template is very transferable into the civilian world. And it actually makes you look a lot smarter and better than you really are, because, as we used to joke, that the civilians who hadn't gone through our training are disadvantaged because they don't understand how to navigate a complex world like we do. I plan to make Special Forces my career. Recovered from my wounds and so on, and then my high school counselors kept writing me in Vietnam. So as I mentioned to you earlier, the idea of a mentor. And these guys loved me. Mr. Blau and Mr. DeGrand at DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx. We got bused from Harlem up to the Bronx. Every year I would drop out and I'd come back and they'd get me back in and I played ball, then the coach would find out I'm not going to school and I'd get kicked out again. And we had no phone in my house. We were very poor, so they couldn't contact my parents. And I got away with a lot. But they kept sending me letters. I still have the letters. And, Carmona, you really have a lot of potential. And go to school, get an education, do something great. You know, my mom used to tell me that. Get your education. You don't have to live like us. You can really do something important to change the world. And so they found out when I came home. They sent me letters in Vietnam. But when I came home, they contacted me. And they said, you should go to college. Now, my teammates and my commander had said, you should go to college. I didn't take SATs. There's no way I was going to get in. But they said, do you remember? And they named the professor from the high school. And he says, yeah, he's now the assistant dean at the Bronx Community College. And they have an open enrollment program for combat veterans. And they don't care if you're a high school dropout. They'll take you. So I remember thinking, oh, hell, I'm screwed now. I got to go to college, which was probably riskier than going to combat because you really will expose your flaws there. So I went into reserve status. I went to college.
Dr. Carmona squeezed out every ounce of his potential behind an unmatched ability to focus and an understanding of how to assess risk.
Very focused and very disciplined. My 24-hour day was locked in. The time I worked out, the time I would work, the time I would go to school. And unlike most of the college students who were worried about silly things, I had a focus. I had a mission. I needed to prove to people, because I had a year to matriculate. And as long as I did well, I could stay in and matriculate. Otherwise, you get kicked out. So I became an A student, worked real hard. And as I've often said to my kids, I was never the smartest kids in the class, but I was the most focused and disciplined. I understood what my mission was. I understood what the elements of success were going to be graded on. I understood what I needed to know to pass that test to be moved to the next level. So again, deliverables, resources, timing, all of the things I learned. But I didn't think of it that way back then, Jay. It wasn't years till years later that I thought, God, I understand why now. I there was a methodology that was given to me by the military to be able to funnel everything I was going to do through a certain lens and figure out real quickly how to do it, what I need, what are deliverables, and so on. So I then I've worked many jobs. A ocean lifeguard, taught scuba, taught parachuting, taught tactics, police officer, registered nurse, paramedic. Every one of those jobs are based on skills I learned in the Army and Special Forces. Every single one. And allowed me to do a lot of things. And then I had, going through college, I went to the West Coast to finish college. And I was trying to play some sports and I couldn't do both. I went and tried out and got a slot on a football team and was running track into junior college, but it was real tough to be an athlete, as you well know, and be an A student and think about going to medical school and have a family and a kid. So that went by the wayside. I kind of regretted it, but I still kept myself in shape. I did my religiously an hour or two a day. I was doing something, pushing the envelope physically, because that was part of my life from being in the military, being in Special Forces. And it separated me from most of my colleagues in school because I had a focus and a discipline that they didn't have. Although they were inherently smarter, I had the leg up because I was disciplined. And did well in college, eventually, becoming an A student. And then thought, what the hell, I'm going to try to go to medical school. If I don't, there's a half a dozen jobs I can do that I've already done, and I can stay in law enforcement, I can be a paramedic, I can stay as a nurse, I can teach. So, do government contracting. It was tough. So, but I always looked at that as a major risk because I'm going to commit this, and if I don't make it, I'm going to be a failure. And so I applied to a bunch of medical schools and ended up actually getting into several. And I chose then to go to the University of California, San Francisco. Largely, I did have notice. I got some Eastern schools too, but my first acceptance was in February, and I was in Long Beach, California when I got the call, and it was snowing and like slush and 20 degrees in New York, and I was in a phone booth at 70 degrees in Southern California. I said, I accepted, But then I knew that if I get something on the West Coast, I'm going to go to there. And eventually I got other acceptances, and I stayed at UC San Francisco, which was the most highly rated medical school in the country at the time, and still is always in the top 3, 4, 5. And I went to UCSF. I had to downgrade a lot of my extracurricular activities, working with the Department of Defense and still doing teaching and tactics. It was, you know, I had to focus on this mission. But I kept the connections. I'd never let them go. You know, I'd always hang with the guys. Guys would come to town. I'd run with them. I became a resource for them. And there was just something about the privilege of being a member of that band of brothers that you have shared battle experiences with, whether it be law enforcement or whether it be military. And my wife, fortunately, was always very accepting of that, being her father was a retired New York City detective and her uncle was, and so she understood. Even though she didn't approve, she understood. Because as you know, your significant other lives every deployment with you, lives every mission with you, lives every gunshot wound with you. And after a while, it gets old, you know, being scared that you ain't coming home one day, whether it's military or civilian. And so in medical school, I did very, very well. And again, this is quite honestly, people attributed this great intelligence. It had nothing to do with intelligence. I had average intelligence, but I had superhuman tenacity, and I had great, great, extraordinary planning and strategic thinking that I got from the military. So while all the other kids in medical school, 150 kids in my class, few of us were veterans, the older guys. Then you had the youngsters. They're, you know, all in their little groups of the surfer group and this group and that group, and they all feed off each other, and they're all worried about getting an A. And I wasn't worried about getting an A or B. I said, my mission is to get out of medical school, okay? Because we used to say, what do you call the guy that graduates last in the class of medical school? Doctor, okay? I'm getting out of here one way or another, and I'm going to get out with my class. And so while they were all worried and reading all night and everything, I had partitioned the day into certain hours. Get up in the morning, I'd do a little review, I'd go to school. After a while, I would recognize which classes I need to go to and which I could just study the syllabus. Most days at lunchtime, I would take an hour to 2 hour break. I'd run through Golden Gate Park. I'd do a 5 mile run most days. Every other day, I'd do a weight circuit. I'd swim 3 times a week. I was in about the best shape I was in my whole life, like I was back in Special Forces. But that was my mindset. And then I'd get home at 5 o'clock. I'd have dinner with my family, and then I'd study from 7 to 10 every night. Bed 10 and 11, up 0600, boom, and get going. And just regimented. And you couldn't break me from that stride, okay? And so I volunteered for a lot of electives, and I was given the opportunity to take higher-level electives because the instructors knew that my Special Forces background, I'd been in combat, and I was a Special Forces medic and a weapons specialist. So, you know, they start, well, have you ever put in a chest tube? Have you sewn a wound? Have you done? Yeah, I've done all of that stuff. So they let me take classes above my skill level, and I did real well. And as it turns out, I didn't realize that I volunteered for so much stuff that I actually skipped my last year of medical school. And I graduated number one in my class because I was the most focused and disciplined, not because I was the smartest. And, there were a lot of kids in my class that were brilliant, but they couldn't stay focused on the mission. They were all over the place. I knew my mission. Then I went on into residency, and I trained as a general vascular surgeon. Did that for a number of years. And then you and I met when I came to Tucson to start the first trauma and emergency medical system. And there was no system here. So coordinating the paramedics, the EMTs, the docs, all the law enforcement agencies, putting together the program for Level 1 Trauma Center, and of course with law enforcement.
Dr. Carmona got his start in law enforcement as the medical director for the Arizona State Police.
The state police had asked me, would you mind being our medical director? And they had the only helicopter, so that had to be part of the EMS system. So I said, sure, that'd be great. And they said, well, you know anything about helicopters? I said, I got a couple of thousand hours in them, you know, rappelling, jumping, rescuing, medevacs, you know, inserts, exfills. So he said, well, that's great. Would you want to teach some of our guys that? I said, sure. So I started doing it, and the captain was, a naval intelligence officer in the reserves himself. And he says, do you know this stuff pretty good? I said, well, it was my life. And he said, you know, why don't you get your certification, go to the academy and, you know, get your commission as a police officer. And you'd be a medical director, but you'd be a cop too. I said, okay, so that was a problem because back then the academy, you had to live at the academy for 20 weeks. And I was working. I said, I can't do that. So I challenged him. One of his colleagues ran the academy. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I will take every test that every police officer takes. I'll go to the classes I have to go to on my own, if you'll give me permission to do that. And I don't want you to do anything less for me because I'm a doctor. But if I pass all of my tests and FTO and everything like everybody else, then because I'm going to have to add this on because I'm supporting a family and everything else. And many of the people heard about it and said, well, he's never going to be able to do that. But they didn't know me. I said, I'm going to do it. Rain, shit, butter, blood. I'm going to do it. I mean, I don't care if I have to do it at night or days. And I did, and it took me a number of months. But then I was able to do that and flew air rescue. I was a medical, actually the flight surgeon and medical director for the EMS system and air rescue. And back then there was only one helicopter. So we did law enforcement, search and rescue, and patient transport. So it was fantastic. Everything in my background I was able to do, plus be the chief doc for the EMS system and the trauma system. And I wrote the schedule so I could schedule myself to do shifts with the helicopter, shifts in the field. And of course, you know, my wife says, you're going to come home once in a while, you know. But it was great having a second chance to be an operator. And that's when I met the sheriff and the leaders here in Pima County. One day I was on the governor's plane flying to Mexico with the governor, the sheriff, and the DPS guys to do one of these international exchange program things. And they wanted somebody who knew about emergency medicine and trauma. And I went down, and I, on the way down with the sheriff and the major at the time, he says, well, we heard about you, and what are you doing? And I told him, and I said, well, you ought to be on our SWAT team. I said, well, I'm up here, you know. They said, yeah, but you live in Tucson, and your base is in Phoenix, and you travel a lot. He said, you know, you have your post-certification. You could lateral and come to the sheriff's department. And I said, well, that's interesting. And I said, well, what would I do? I said, why don't you come down and talk to us? And I said, we have a SWAT team. We're pretty active, and you are fit right in. And I said, okay. And I said, he didn't know the requirements. I said, what are the requirements? So the next week, I went and spoke to them. I went out one day to SWAT training and met some of the guys. And, of course, I didn't know a lot of them. And they kind of look at you a little, you know, who's this guy? But, you know, I made my case and said, look, I'd like to come in. I'll try out. I'll do any tests you want. I don't expect any special, you know, privileges. But this is back in 85, 86. And I said, you know, show me what everybody else does and I'll do it. And so it was tough because, as you know, Jay, it's harder for a guy coming from the outside because everybody's looking for you to fail. They're looking for you. You can't do it. But as I said, I always kept myself physically fit. My shooting skills were great. You know, I was able to do everything real well. And it got to the point where I was accepted on the team because the sheriff told the guy he's coming on the team. But that's not the way you come on a team. You have to earn your right. So, you know, I became the low guy in the totem pole and took all the crap from the guys and carried the water and covered the, you know, the 1-4 corner when all the action was on the other side. And, you know, everything that a rookie would do on a tactical team because I recognize that's the rite of passage. And then gradually I moved up. And as I came on the team, I was going to be the medic on the team. And I trained EMTs and paramedics because we had dual trained officers who were also medics. Tom Price, who you know, Mike Duffy, all those guys from the old days. But as it turns out, as I got more and more involved, and then I took on the role of training officer, and then I was asked to be the team leader. And so I ended up being the SWAT team leader and the training officer and put together all of the protocols, the policies, procedures, barricade, hostage, rescue, active shooter, published a lot within the national tactical areas. And I had this dual life. I was working as a cop and working as a doc, and I loved it. And again, stressed my wife quite a bit because she used to say, God gives everybody 9 lives and you're at 11 already, you know, and you're pushing the envelope. And as you know, there's a couple of funny stories that happened after that when I was hitting. But when you and I met, when you got shot and you, similar situation to mine, you stepped in the path of a bullet in your rookie year, and we became friends, and I got to care for you for a while, and that's what, 30-something years ago that we got to do that together. And it's ever since that time, we've been friends and watched each other's back as our careers moved in different directions. And so then I stayed on the team for many years, and probably a couple of decades, and just loved it. Just loved the op-tempo, loved doing the high-risk things, because essentially it was civilian special operations, just like Army Special Forces. Shorter duration, high op-tempo, things like that.
As a bit of a surprise, Dr. Carmona was selected by President Bush to be his United States Surgeon General. He became emotional when speaking about the experience.
And then, as you know, not expecting this, in 2002, call from the White House and says, would you like to be, the president would like to know, he said, well, the president is recruiting for a new Surgeon General. And we know you have military experience and background in a lot of different areas, and bioterrorism and WMD and emergency preparedness and disaster management. Would you like to be considered? And quite frankly, Jay, as you know, I thought the first time, this is guys on the team who are calling me to screw with me, okay? Because you know how they do things. So I figured, no downside, okay. And I started this interview process that took a few months, never expecting I was going to get the job, because if anything, I am the most apolitical guy in the world. I am pretty critical of both parties, you know, because of their lack of focus, lack of integrity. And I'm painting a wide-ranging blanket on this too. But, let me put it this way. As I look at the political scene on both sides of the aisle, I think we can do so much better. Let me put it that way. And so I didn't think that I would be the person to be nominated, because I was usually pretty critical. I called them like I see them. I didn't care. It's like being a cop. I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat. You broke the law, we're going to arrest you, okay? And that was kind of the mindset. And like I would tell my colleagues in Washington, when later years when I was Surgeon General and we'd have these discussions and I'd get very frustrated, I said, let me tell you something. You guys have ultimate authority to pass policy to send our greatest asset downrange into harm's way in combat, okay? And you do that, okay? And you do it ostensibly for the benefit of the United States because of who we are. And when I go to the wall in Washington and I touch the wall of my vital buddies who died, and I remember some of them being with them when they died, and I still cry. I said, but you know what? I have no idea if any one of them was a Republican or a Democrat, because you guys sent us down there as Americans, and you guys can't get your shit together, okay? You keep fighting over petty stuff. We didn't have the opportunity to do that. We went down and went in harm's way and did what you said. And I said, that's what this country's about, not this crazy partisanship that you guys deal with. Anyway, back to the process. I eventually, thought I was going to get rejected. And it got to be a big deal in town because it was in the papers that I was being considered. And all the muckety-mucks in town said, oh, you know, you're not really on the inside track. I mean, it's really nice you've gotten nominated or considered for nomination. But, you know, this is going to go to a high-profile political or something like that. And I said, yeah, I know that, but that's okay. You know, I'm still here as a SWAT guy and I can do what I want. I'm a doc and everything's fine. And then one day I got I was getting down to the short list, so I made out a little card, a 3x5 card, and I called it my rejection speech with dignity. And in that card, I knew they're going to call me one day, and they're going to tell me I'm a great American, but they're going to tell me you're not going to get the job. So I had a speech written out on the card so I could go out with dignity that said something like, thank you, whoever calls me. Please let the president know I am very happy that he considered me. But if there are other senior leadership positions, I'd be happy to consider that. But I do appreciate the opportunity to be considered. So one day, the secretary calls me and says, it's the chief of staff from the White House. I was like, oh, well. Took out the card, put it on the table. He says, Dr. Carmona. I said, yes, sir. He says, well, I'd like to know what you're doing, you know, March 15th, I think was the date he said. And I started to answer. He said, well, we really want to know what your kids and your family are doing. I thought, oh, hell, if they interview my kids, I will not get the job. How am I going to get out of this? He says, well, we met with the president just now, and the decision's unanimous. The president would like to know, can you come to Washington on that day? He's going to have a press conference where he will nominate you to be the Surgeon General of the United States. And I said, you're shitting me. And he said, no, sir, I'm not. Then your life changes. You become a public figure overnight. Everybody in town who said that you had no chance all of a sudden says they were the ones that got you the job and called the president on your behalf. And, as they say, success has 1,000 fathers and failure is an orphan. And went to the White House, and it was an extraordinary event. Family, and the president was magnanimous, the staff was magnanimous, and we were, you know, in the big room and the press conference, and he was just the most gracious guy in the world and thanking me for willing to come back and serve my country. And I was speechless. You know, my son, who was in the Army, was a Spec 4. He didn't want to wear his uniform because he said, "Dad, I'm going to be there with all those generals and admirals, and I don't want to embarrass you. I'm going to just wear a suit." I said, "Wear your damn uniform. Be proud of it." When we walked into the Oval Office, the first person the president went to was my son Jason and hugged him, said, "Thank you for serving your country." Jason looked at me and said, "Dad, you were right." I said, "Sure." And so he repeated a lot of stuff that Senator Kyle and Senator McCain said when I was introduced on the Senate floor. You know, very nice stuff. But he said, the country's at a different time now where terrorism is in our forefront. And not only do we need a doctor, we need somebody who understands the military. We need somebody who understands tactics and terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. And he said, there ain't a lot of guys like that around, but we found Rich. And it was still kind of a surreal experience. And then I went home, and after a couple of months of discussions, you come back and you have to go to the Senate for confirmation. So the president only gets to ask the Senate, "Can you come in?" He has to ask the Senate, "We want Rich to come back on active duty as an admiral, as the Surgeon General of the United States," and the Senate approves it. So there's a lot of stories there too, and I won't go into them. Some of them funny, some of them good. But ultimately, I went to the Senate confirmation hearing. It took a little over 2 hours. And I became the first Surgeon General in history, they tell me, to be confirmed unanimously by the Senate.
Behind his police experience, Dr. Carmona was selected as the National Association of Police Officers top cop.
Then I took the job, and as you know, one of the funny things that happened to me was one of the awards I got over the years was being recognized as a national top cop before I was Surgeon General, when I was a SWAT guy. And I got a call from the National Police Organization and said, "Hey, Surgeon General, well, we'd like you to come and talk to our list of officers this year who are going to become national top cop." I said, "For sure. Let me talk to my staff. We'll get it." And they said, "By the way, there's a guy that we're considering that I think you know." "Well, who's that?" He said, "Jay Dobbins." I said, "No, you're kidding me." So, Jay, you remember that I said, "Don't tell him. I'm going to hide behind stage, and then I'm going to come out and give him his award." And that's what we did. And Jay didn't know I was there. And after all the years of knowing each other, we met again on a stage in Washington at the Ford Theater, where he received his National Top Cop Award from another old-timer who had gotten the award a few years before him. So what a small world. And since that time, you know, after my time, it's a 4-year statutory term, retired as an admiral, and came home and just resumed doing all the duties I'm doing, and still stayed with the Sheriff's Department, Peoria County Sheriff's Department, for 34 years now, and you know, downgraded a little bit. I mean, I'm not going through the door anymore. I do some teaching, do admin and policy work, but the department asked me to stay on, and this year I was going to retire, and they said no. When COVID hit, they said, "No, you got to stay now for sure," and so I love it, but I'm saddened that most of the officers I work with are as old as my kids or grandkids, and yet it's great to be among these young warriors who are terrific. And then I run into Jay again after all these years when he retires, and now he's a football coach, and he's got a podcast, and he says, "Hey, let's talk on my podcast." So isn't the world a wonderful place?
Dr. Carmona's extraordinary courage was put on display when he became a critical member of a search and rescue team attempting to locate a downed medical helicopter.
I think I was out to dinner with my wife. It was about 8:30. And again, being a SWAT team leader and also interfacing with search and rescue a lot, because some of the guys on SWAT had collateral duty doing search and rescue. And as you know, in this county, which is 10,000 square miles, we do hundreds of rescues every year up in the mountains, because we have altitudes up to about 9,000 feet down to sea level almost, and we cover from the mountains at Mount Lemmon out to Ajo, which is about 120 miles, so it's a huge county. And finishing dinner, I got a page that to call COM, and I called in, and they said, "Just want to let you know, one of the," I should preface my remarks by saying, for years, the only helicopter doing search and rescue, medical transport, and law enforcement was the Department of Public Safety helicopter. The city had a helicopter that did law enforcement within the city limits. So, but now there were a number of private helicopters flying. And we all knew them. Some, in fact, some of their staff we trained because they were new into the business. So the helicopter was missing. It was on the way from, I believe, St. Mary's Hospital to Mount Graham Hospital. And there was snow up there. The weather was bad. It was about 8:30 at night. So I told my wife, take me down to the hangar and then go home. I want to go see what's going on. And, of course, she was... Why are you going to do that? I said, well, some people's lives are at risk. Let me see what's going on. And I didn't have my rescue police vehicle with me, my SWAT vehicle. I was at my POV. And so she dropped me off. And just then, the air rescue helicopter was taken off to go. And the customs helicopter was coming in after because they had requested customs because the weather was so bad, you'd have to fly IFR. And but Ranger, the DPS helicopter, which flew visual, was going to try anyway and see if they could see anything. So they went up, and they got battered. They said it was terrible, you know, the snow and the wind. So they came back, and then I went up with the customs helicopter, and we flew for about an hour. And it was like flying in combat. I mean, it was just white out because of the snow. And, you know, you couldn't see any terrain features, and they were flying all IFR. And so we just sat down, and by then... groups had started to come into the Fort Grant prison area in the mountains to set up a base camp and an incident command system. Helicopter missing, no ELT, no emergency beacon that was shown, and so we didn't know. But we were worried, and we thought, well, pilot may have just sat down and can't communicate now, but the weather was so bad because they were flying visual. So, okay, an experienced pilot had a flight nurse and a paramedic. All of whom we know. The flight nurse we trained, the medic, he was in our EMS system, we worked with him, and the pilot we knew. So it was a personal thing too, even though they were flying for a civilian company and we were law enforcement. So I decided to stay up there overnight and work in the incident command system and come up with a plan to search as soon as we could in the morning. There was nothing we could do at night. And by then, the dog teams had showed up and the rescue teams had showed up and multi-county response and had a huge incident command system that was opening up, you know, food and resources and everything that you do in an ICS. And then early in the morning, I called back to the supervisor for our team and said, I asked him a favor. I said, I don't know where this is going to go, but probably one of the most experienced search and rescue guys in the country, who was one of my SWAT partners, a guy named Tom Price. And I said to the supervisor, I said, there's a couple of helicopters coming up to relieve. Can Tom come up and bring our equipment with us? And just in case something happens, at least we got a couple of us here who know what we're doing. There were probably 100 different rescuers up there by now from all different departments. But there was no air support because everybody came up in the ground and dogs and everything. And so when the snow stopped in the morning and it cleared and it was still very windy, you couldn't even see the mountain. It was just snow. It was a whiteout. It looked like the Alps. And so Tommy flew up early in that morning with Ranger helicopter, Ranger 32, piloted by Lauren Leonberger, who since has passed, Vietnam veteran, combat veteran, over 20 years Army, just one of the best pilots in the world. Al Quesada, crew chief, who DPS officer, fantastic guy, medic, crew chief, and they brought Tom up. And then they started doing a visual reconnaissance. And about 9 o'clock in the morning, Tom says, I see movement in the snowbank at about 8,600 feet. And they got a little closer, but they couldn't get too close because they caused an avalanche with the prop blast. So they're watching. So Tom calls me on the radio down at the base camp and says, we got somebody alive up here. Turns out that the night before, I think it was a passenger jet coming in, picked up an ELT, an emergency locator transponder, in that area. And, you know, that was the information was given, but you couldn't do anything with it because you couldn't see anything. You couldn't go anyplace. So we then did a hasty briefing. The air ops guy, who was Lauren, who landed, came in, and we all briefed. And then everybody was trying, well, who's going to do this rescue? And Lauren and I and Tom had worked together many, many years, you know, doing rescues, doing inserts, doing exfills on technical missions, doing rescue, so there was a comfort level. So a lot of people wanted to do the rescue, but since Loren was the chief pilot, and all the other aircraft that we could have used were not available. Hoist level type things. The Blackhawks we didn't want because the prop blast would have caused an avalanche. So we had to get something that had could get up high enough, get us inserted or rappel in, but that would not disrupt the snow and cause a problem. And so by then, we had searched all night, and all of the media helicopters were up there. So we actually needed an air controller there because there were so many helicopters flying around to take pictures. So we got the FAA to clear the airspace only for the rescue helicopters. And then Lauren, as the air commander, you know, and the ICS just said, look, we're going to go up there and give this a try. The best chopper we have is Ranger 32. It's underpowered. Flying at altitude in that wind, I'm at a red line. He said, so I got to dump fuel, I got to dump the doors, all the equipment comes out, and I can only take one rescuer up at a time. So he and I and Tommy talked a little bit, and he just said, I'm not going to do it with any other guys. He said, this is going to be very dangerous, and you know, I've flown with you guys, I've done rescues with you guys, and he said, and I need people who are experienced. So it'll be you two guys. And so he made the decision. I said, okay, we'll do it. So I didn't have any of my own gear. I had a flight suit on, so you know, I had to borrow. We did everything hasty. We made hasty rappel, what do you call it, Swiss seats, chest harness. We took parachute rigging cords. I mean, everything was done improvisational. Lauren went up, dumped the fuel, doors off, seats out. And even at altitude, he was close to red line because of the winds and holding the position. So I went up first, and we did, you know, long rappels in to stay away. And then he towed me in, got real close as much as he could. Then I got in and I got to the crash site. And the problem was you're up to your waist in snow and on a slope like this, and you can't see anything. So you kind of step in a couple of inches at a time, moving across. And then when I got there, you could see the helicopter clearly went into the hillside at maximum speed, and it just burst. So the flight nurse and the pilot were in their seats upside down in trees. You could see them, but they were up higher. And the helicopter pieces were here. The flight paramedic was alive, Glenn Velarde. And he had covered himself in the debris overnight to stay warm. He was hypothermic. Both legs were broken, open fractures. He had burns, second-degree burns. And he had almost scalped from the impact, but he lived. He had been a big, muscular guy, very in shape. He was in the back seat sitting backwards. So the other two got blown out. He got blown out but stayed in the seat. And he had his wherewithal and covered himself with the debris, but he was very hypothermic. He was essentially like a popsicle. He couldn't move. And probably pretty near death when we got to him. And then Tommy came up and rappelled down and came to me, but we had no equipment. So we hastily decided, Tom weighs like a big football player, about 260 pounds, and I'm 185, 190. So we decided I'm the lighter, so I'll go out first. So we got Glenn up and made me the sked. In other words, I was the stretcher. We strapped Glenn to me with a chest harness and a Swiss seat using D-rings, and so he couldn't rotate. And then Glenn saw me. He knew me, and he was in and out of consciousness, and he just said, Rich, what's happening? I said, Glenn, you're going to have to trust me, man. You crashed last night, and Tommy and I are here. We're going to take care of you. So he was so cold. I mean, the shivers and rigid that he couldn't even bend. So I opened my flight suit, and I put his head under my armpit. And I said, and I was joking with him. I said, it ain't going to smell real good, but it's warm. So I said, stay there. Trust me. And don't look down because we're going to be flying. And then we got hooked up, gave the thumbs up. And Lauren did the most magnificent flying because he held a helicopter. You could have put a glass of wine on the dashboard. He was into the rocks, literally a couple of feet. And when you listen to Al give it, because he had to hold the cyclic and collective and look right at the rocks. Al Quesada's hanging out the door looking at us, and you hear the commands. He's telling Lauren, move 2 feet to the right, move 3 feet to the left. I mean, it was amazing. The only reason we could do this rescue was the pilot was so, just extraordinary. And, you know, with thousands of hours of flying, combat tours, you know, slicks, gunships, you couldn't have had a better pilot. Yeah, just a fantastic guy. And so he held it, and then when they got to sign up, we went up, and it was like his flying was so precise that he took us up several hundred feet away from the rocks almost like an elevator. No pendulum, nothing, just straight. Then the helicopter turned like this, and he went at the minimum speed to be able to stay altitude. So he was flying slow. And then we just went for about, 5, 6, 7 miles like that through the air. And there's a famous picture of us dangling at the end of a 100-foot rope, Glenn tied to me, and it was used in one of those rescue TV shows as the opening thing many years later. And then then we went to Fort Grant, put him down. He got taken to the trauma center, got fixed up. Tommy and I then did our after-action report, went home, and that night went to a UA basketball game. After I got home, it was funny, because I got home, it was around noontime, and I parked my department car outside, and I walked in, and I knocked on the door, and my daughter was there, who you know. She says, "Oh, you're in trouble." I said, "Why?" She says, "Mom, saw you on TV. That rescue was on TV." I said, "Could she see my face?" She said, "No." I said, "Okay." So she comes to the door, and it was funny. She says, "I was watching my soap, the one I love to watch every day at noon, and it got preempted by some crazy guys doing a rescue from a helicopter." I said, "Really?" She said, "Was that you?" I said, "Did it look like me?" And she said, "I couldn't tell, it was too far away." I said, "Well, you know how we say, if you don't got pictures, you don't have anything." She said, "That was you, wasn't it?" I said, "No, it wasn't me." I said, "You know, we were just there helping." She found out later it was me. And she says, "You know, you got to stop doing this crazy stuff." I said, "You know, it was one of our friends. We saved him, you know, and he would have died." And the flight nurse who we know, her dad is a doctor in Tucson, and we knew him too. And her brother of the flight nurse was the assistant principal at the school my kids went to over at Fruchtendler. You know, so it was this very tight community. So it was very gratifying that we could save one of our own. And, you know, fortunately for both Tommy and I, we'd had decades of training and experience and using ropes and rappelling and climbing, and you know that it was difficult, but the difficult part really was the pilot. You know, you couldn't do that rescue without, you know, a really superb pilot and a crew chief that understood everything. You know, they put us in, we did our thing, but again, you know, Tommy and I, up to the day he died and after, we praise Lauren Leonberger as just, you know, one of our heroes. He was a most humble, quiet, career military, career police officer, and just fantastic guy. Married to a trauma nurse, okay? So a very small family, we all knew each other. And unfortunately, his wife just died this year of heart disease. And he died a number of years before that. So we're thankful that we had these great warriors with us, who understood how to complete a mission, were willing to undertake risk for the benefit of others. But we mitigated that risk by having an extraordinary pilot and a team that had pretty extensive experience in doing these kind of things.
As a member of the Pima County Sheriff's Department, Dr. Carmona was shot while serving as the point man of a hostage rescue operation.
I was one of the team leaders on an entry team, cordoned off the house, did the usual things, calling the guy out, and you know, and then he had been shooting up the neighborhood and was just deranged. And unfortunately, it was a miscommunication on the radios. One of our operators moved into the line of fire, not knowing or not hearing what had just come over the radio, which was a 10-0, which is heads up, don't move. And so Tommy Price, again, my partner and I, had to go forward. We said, we can't let him out there alone. We went forward. The guy had already taken shots at the patrol car in front. You know, neighborhood had been evacuated. We did all the usual. We had one of our guys who was a former Marine, a retired Marine sniper, who was about as good as you can get, Vietnam veteran. He's on the roof about 100 yards away. Guy comes out shooting and has slung weapons, guns in his hand, shooting. He turns. He sees us. We move to him. The sniper takes him out immediately. Center punch. As he drops, round goes off. I get a through and through to the thigh. And you know, I did okay. I had to go to surgery. I got cleaned up. And I was running in a few days. Had a big hole in my leg, but it healed. And got you know, didn't stop me too much. Got back in training. And, you know, it was one of those things that, in retrospect, we could have done it better. We had a little mishap internally, communications. We got exposed, and in retrospect, had that communication not been misinterpreted and that other officer had exposed himself that cost my partner and I to move into another location, probably wouldn't have happened because the sniper would have taken him out. And then when it was code four, we'd have moved forward, you know, disarm, cuff, do all the usual things. So, you know, the missions always don't turn out perfectly. And I would say that, especially in special operations, both in the military, where I was in special forces, and in SWAT team, we brought a degree of rigor to our evaluations, and we were our most critical critics. You know, no matter how well it is, we can always do it better. We can do it more efficient, effective, safer, and we would always push ourselves to say, okay. And a lot of times, as you know, Jay, we'd say we shouldn't take credit for this one just because the bad guy is dumber than we were and did something stupid. How do we do this better next time? And I can tell you, you know, writing hundreds of papers over the years and practicing, you know, the special operations tactics is always evolving based on the threats before you. And you're only as good as you're staying up with all of the options and that you can take on any given message, a mission, whether it is a, you know, simple warrant that you're serving. As you know, warrants ain't simple usually. A barricaded subject, hostage rescue, active shooters, all of those tactical areas. So this one, we were critical of ourselves, and we did some internal changes to ensure that doesn't happen again.
Dr. Carmona was off duty when he encountered an armed murderer in a city street intersection, surrounded by pedestrians. Rich engaged in a public shootout.
I was in civilian clothes. I was driving across town, going to my daughter's house to have dinner, and then my partner and I, Tom Price again, we were flying to the National Tactical Conference in Virginia, where we were going to be presenting, and I was doing a presentation the next day on unexpected high-risk encounters. Okay, so this fits nicely into this one, because I'm in civilian clothes. I have hiking boots on, shorts, and a polo shirt in my SWAT vehicle, which is an unmarked car, which has all of my weapons, the protective devices, explosives, everything there. Under my seat, I have my duty weapon at the time, which was a Colt Series 80 45. And, you know, I had backup weapons in the car. I had a shotgun, but, you know, they're all cached in different areas in the car. And so as I'm driving across Grant and Campbell, 1 hour before the U of A basketball game, so it's in gridlock, entire gridlock. Cars aren't moving. People are wall to wall in this intersection, waiting to cross the street to go to the stadium that you used to play football in at the U of A. And I see there's a three-car collision. And, you know, these are challenges all police officers go through. Should I stop? Should I go on? So I look and I see people on the sidewalk. I see a lady is bleeding from her head. I see other people looking like they're injured on the sidewalk. So I'm like, okay, I got to stop. So I just tell my daughter quickly. I said, I got an emergency. I got to stop. There's people injured, and I'll be at dinner in a little while. It's a couple of miles from where her house was. So I get on the radio. And, you know, back then we used to call badge numbers. I said 509, just on-sited at 1050 meaning. I got a vehicle crash but unknown injuries. I'm going to check. Please send patrol, traffic unit, EMS, and I'll stay here and provide first aid till they get here, which is routine. So I put on my coat equipment and I drive into traffic to stop the traffic because the cars were passing real close to these people who were injured, you know, and they're trying to get to the game and they see people injured and they just, so I drive on oncoming traffic. So people have to go around my car now and we're just short of the intersection and I get out of the car and again, I'm in shorts. So the first thing I do is take out my flat badge and I said, I'm a police officer. I've already called for help. Who's most injured, you know, and I'm trying to, people start running over to me and they're holding me. I said, what's the matter? They say, he's got a gun. He tried to shoot us. I said, who? And, you know, it was like, I see injured people and three cars that are crunched and it's right on the curbside. So I said, who? In the car right over there. And they're pointing. So I get back on the radio and I say, 509, be advised. I'm told there's a suspect here, 1032, meaning he's got a gun and he threatened somebody, but I don't see anybody. So get me a 1078, 1018. This is verbatim from the trip. They're saying, I want to back up quick as possible. Well, you can't get there because there's gridlock. So I hear in the distance, I start hearing sirens. And in the very far distance, quarter mile away, I can see lights, you know, code lights, but they can't get any place. So I got the radio. probably a half a dozen times, I'm holding my badge up to the crowd who's all looking at me like this is a video game and saying, I am a police officer. Because what I didn't want to happen is, because everybody in Arizona has a gun, somebody sees me holding a gun and shoots me because I'm a bad guy. And I'm saying, I'm a police officer. I said, everybody stay back. So the people that are holding me, I got them back to the curb. I said, go there behind the car. Let me figure this out. And I went back to my patrol, it wasn't a patrol field, unmarked car, and I reached in under the seat where I always know my weapon is. And in fact, my team and my SWAT guys, we used to actually do drills in the dark so that everybody knew exactly where their ammo was, where their cuffs were, where everything was, because if you have to get it, you don't have time to turn on a light. So I knew where it was, and I knew how it was anchored, so I just pulled it out, put it in my belt, had my radio, and I came back online. I says, I don't see anybody, but I started calling, and there was the third car, which was, I think, 18 yards, something like that, away. I don't remember the exact amount when the crime scene guys came and measured it. And it was a pickup truck that was blacked out windows, so you couldn't see. So I was not going to make an approach alone without a backup. I didn't know who was in the car. I didn't know who was in the other cars. So I stayed back and just said, you guys stay there. There was nobody in urgent need of care. There were people that were hurt. So I keep calling and I keep calling and half a dozen times. I'm a police officer. If you're injured, please come out of the car. Please come out of the car. And finally, the door opens and I see the guy come out of the car. But Jay, when he comes out of the car, out of the driver's seat, and okay, I'm like I said, between 15, 20 yards away from him. I'm behind my car, my unmarked car, and he steps out of the car, and I'm looking directly, let's say I'm on Grant, looking directly east, and he steps out of the car, and all I see is his back. So he's like this, and of course, what is the first thing you say? Let me see your hands. Nothing. Let me see your hands. Nothing. About the third or fourth time, this is what I see, Jay. So, two things. I know he understands me because I thought maybe he has a head injury and he's distracted or something, or disoriented. But when he does show me one hand, it tells me he doesn't want to show me the other hand. So I got on the radio again, and I said, 509. 1018 on that 78. I got a suspect out that may be 1032, non-compliant. You know, words to that effect. And then the guy turns, and he's got a semi-automatic pistol in his hand. And he looks at me, I look at him, but I've got a sight picture on him already, and I'm screaming at him with my badge up, and my flat badge, and I'm right by the side of my car. And I said, sir, put the gun down. Just put the gun down on police officer. And I'm really afraid, quite frankly, I'm going to get shot from everybody around me. But I'm screaming, I'm a police officer. And when they reviewed the tapes, they said it was like 15, 20 times. So it was clear. And then what he did was he stood there and he had that, you'll know what I say when I, and these are police officers listening to this. He had a meth stare. He just locked on me like this. And he did this and he had the weapon and he started rocking, with the muzzle pointing at the ground, and just rocked, looking at me. And I had a sight picture on him then, like this. And I said, put the gun down. I'm here to help you. Put the gun down. Must have said that a half a dozen times. And then he started bending down. And when the gun was almost on the ground, right about here, boom, first round. Grazes my head, and then the gun battle begins, right there. And I felt a little flinch, but it didn't stop me. I mean, we got a gun battle, okay? It doesn't make a difference as long as I can move. And so it was very scary. And again, you don't have time to think, as you know, Jay Bean and these things. But as I'm looking at the field, there's people all over. Kids, moms, dads, the intersection is packed with cars turning. And we're right there in the middle of traffic. And people are looking at you like it's a video game, like it's not real. And so instinctually, first thing I'm looking for is cover and concealment. There ain't none. I'm in the middle of an intersection. And there's people trying to stay near me to protect them, and I'm trying to push them away. So I grabbed my last transmission, I think, when I grabbed the radio. I said, 509, 998-999. 998, shots fired. 999, officer needs assistant. Desperate. I hear the siren. The TPD guy, the city police guy, they get the call. They're a couple of blocks away. He gets up on the sidewalk, and I see him coming down the sidewalk, code 3. And then I'm thinking, if he doesn't know who I am and sees me with a gun in a gunfight, I could be, But I just kept that aside. And then I move to the right. He's trying to get a sight picture on me. I double tap. First time I get him in the groin. We move again. He's trying to get a sight picture on me. He went down. He gets back up. Hit him in the upper chest. Spins him around. And then he goes down, just about to go on his knees. I get him again, double tap, right center punch, and he goes down. But the amazing thing about this guy, he was in this fight as much as I was, because he never lost sight of me, and he kept tracking me, and even as he was dying on the ground, looking backwards, trying to find me to get another round off. You know, and then at that point, cars come up, officer from the city sees me. I'm screaming, I'm on the job, scene is yours, I haven't cleared the cars, the guy on the ground is a suspect, he's armed. And then as soon as he came to me, I put my weapon down in the trunk of my car, which was open, which is another interesting thing. So he went, they cuffed the guy up, and they took him to the ER, and he died in the ER. Later, when they reconstructed the scene, people said, why did that officer go back and put more bullets in his gun? I never remembered it, did not remember it, but as it turns out, when after about six rounds, I think, or seven, I did a combat reload without even thinking about it. I backed to my car, I knew where the magazines were, because when they reconstructed, my magazine, my 45 magazine still had a round or two, it was on the ground, and I had a full magazine in the weapon. And it was the public who said, we saw him put more bullets in the gun. And the shooting team said, did you do that? I said, I don't remember. I'm going to be honest with you. Well, I said, you must have, because there's a new magazine in the weapon and you're down there. And when I looked at my magazines in the back of the car, they were gone. So I said, hell, that's the value of training. You don't stop to think I need more bullets. You're kind of automatically counting. And if this gunfight is going to go on, I want to still stay in the gunfight. So that's probably what I did. I did that. And then it was a good thing to reinforce how important training is with immediate action drills. If you have to think about reloading, you're probably not doing the right thing. You know, it just has to come naturally. And the fact that you understand what weapon you have. If I got a Glock and I got 14 or 15 rounds, that's a whole lot different than a 45 with 7 or 8 or whatever, you know, whatever the magazine is you're carrying. Mm-hmm. And then I didn't realize that I was hit till later when the ambulances showed up and they said, hey, Rich, you're bleeding. I said, where? And they said, your head. And I said, oh, and I just had a crease right here. But then when they looked where I was standing, my windshield was blown out in the back of the car. There was a hole in the window. One gunshot went right through that window. And I was like, well, you know, that's it. And so then when the county attorney came, he said, what do you said about it? I said, well, I'm supposed to be getting on a plane now with Tommy Price because we're teaching Virginia. Now you got a shooting team here, so I'm going to be stuck here for days. And I said, well, don't worry about it. I said, Rich, do you know who this is? I said, I haven't got any idea. And I said, I didn't get to look at him. They said, well, he gave me the name of the person. And he said, you know, and I said, oh, yeah, I know the name. This was a Southside family that was in trouble a lot. Evidently, he'd just gotten out of prison. And he said that, did you see the car yet? I said, no, I did not get as close to the car as I could have because I couldn't clear it myself, you know, and we ended up in a gun battle. And I said, I would have cleared the car when I got a backup, but not knowing what else was there, it wasn't safe to go with a blackout window. So he said, well, you ought to go look at it. And I looked, and the front seat of the car were filled with weapons and bullets. And evidently he had left his girlfriend back at the house, was on his way to kill his ex-girlfriend or somebody that had testified against him because he had just gotten out of prison. And he had told the young lady, I'm going to come back and get you. Again, this is all what the investigators told me, that he was going to come back and get her and leave town. Oh, by the way, the pickup truck was his father's, who he had just killed and stole his weapons. Then, and so he had told the young lady, you know, if these effing cops try, they ain't taking me back. You know, I'm going to take a lot with me. And I just happened to be the fool who stopped for render first aid. And people thought he was injured in the front of the car because they saw a silhouette sitting there. But he was actually loading magazines in the front seat. And so that's what went down. So by a couple of hours later, the county attorney, after listening, getting statements, he said, if you want to go to Virginia tomorrow, go ahead. He said, this is the cleanest shooting I've had. You know, everybody here has testified, you identified yourself, you screamed police officer. He fired first. And I was critical of myself, and that's an important fact too, because I said I had every opportunity and right to use lethal force when he declined to respond. But kind of the doctor in me was thinking, maybe just head injury, doesn't understand. And then when he pretended like he was going to put down the round, the gun, I was very fortunate to keep my sight picture on him, okay, until he was free of the weapon. But I actually probably, in retrospect, gave him too much time because he got off a round first. And I was fortunate. And it goes to show you how quickly somebody can go from muzzle on the ground to you. You can't react that fast. And I lived through that, and I was very fortunate. So when I reviewed it with my SWAT guys and I reviewed it with the department and we used the scenario as a teaching scenario, recreating it, I was very critical. I told the young officers, never do that. Never do that. Because if this person knows, they don't care if they're going to die and they want to take you with them, you can't. You give them the benefit of the doubt, put it down, you do all of that. But if they don't, then you have every right to stop the threat with lethal force. And so that was where I was critical of myself, that split second is the second between life and death. And I was justified, but I delayed because I thought he was really going to give himself up, and it didn't work out well for him. But nevertheless, I was fortunate that round wasn't a killing shot on me. And so it's then I went to Virginia and taught for a few days, and Tom Price and I came home together.
Dr. Carmona speaks to the overcome mindset necessary to perform under extreme circumstances and survive traumatic injuries.
Well, Jay, as you know, I think you have to develop that mindset you don't get to choose your gunfights or knife fights, okay? But when you're in the fight, it ain't over till it's over. And it's over when the threat is neutralized. So it's not like the movies, things happen. And unless you train for those things and have a bunch of algorithms in your mind with immediate action drills. And, my wife, I would drive her crazy over the years because on the military side, we do that. But even when I would we go into a bank or we go into the movies, okay? She would always tell, first thing I do when I step into the movie theater, where are the exits? Something goes bad here, active shooter or something. I've always done this. And I always sit at an aisle. I keep my back this way, I want a sight picture because I don't know what's going to happen here. And she would always joke. She says, yeah, you don't want to go to the movies with Rich because the first 5 minutes he's looking for exits and what's going on. I go to a bank, same thing. And when I teach in the academy, I used to do that. I would tell the youngsters, so let's, I would teach a course at the end of the academy on risk and I forgot the full name of it, but it was basically, unplanned encounters and how do you deal with them based on the level of threat. And so let's say you're in a bank and you're standing in line and three people in front of you, you see a guy pull out a gun and places it on the counter and passes the teller a note and he's still got his hand on the gun. What do you do? And in the academy, he's like, okay, I'm going to take out my weapon. I'm going to show my badge. I'm going to say, police officer, do this. I said, do you want to do that right then? And I would always bait them because I wanted them to see the real world. This, you have a split second. And I always used to tell the kids in the academy, you have a split second to take all of your accumulated knowledge in your life and compress it into this millisecond to make the right decision on an appropriate use of force. And tomorrow when it's in the papers, they will treat you as if you thought about it for 2 hours. Okay? That's how bad it is. So you better see how important this is. And I'd walk them through and I'd say, so what would you do? Why would you do it? And then I'd say, okay. And then I'd say, let's look at another scenario. Let's say the person that's three or four people in front of you, the bank's crowded, people are waiting on lines Friday afternoon cashing checks, and the person fires a couple of rounds into the ceiling and says, this is a hold up, I want the money. Now what do you do? Okay. And then I say, well, let's say he says it's a hold up and he shoots the guy in the line next to you. Now what do you do? So I walk up through the three scenarios, which, as you know, could be very different as far as tactically response. I said, by the way, let's talk about the scenario where you have your twin girls with you and each of them is holding one of your hands and this happens. Now what do you do? And then they start to, it becomes real. So I said on the first one, you have no reason to do anything. A guy robbed a bank. He had a gun. He didn't shoot anybody. Do you want to get in a shootout with him in the bank? You're in a perfect position to watch him walk out, watch what car he gets into, call out license plate, get in your car if you want to, but don't take a lethal action there because he hasn't hurt anybody, and you're probably safer letting him get out because in a crowded bank, rounds start flying, somebody may get hurt that you don't want to get hurt. Okay, so there's not an exigent circumstance. You have a bank robbery in progress. Call it in. And I said, so, and then the other one, I said, so if he fires a shot. Well, if he fires a shot and it didn't hurt anybody, same kind of issue. What is going to prompt you to take lethal force and put other people's lives in jeopardy? The fact that somebody's been harmed. He put a hole in the ceiling. He put the gun back in his pocket. He took his money. He ran outside. Same situation. Okay? Now, the next situation is he shoots somebody. You have no choice then. You have to, and in fact, you don't even need to identify yourself, okay? But you've got a police officer, people clear out of the way, you do what you have to do to neutralize the threat. Now, what happens when you're holding your two kids there and that happens? What do you do? How do you protect them? That's probably the most extreme. You know, what would you do? And we get into a discussion that, you know, you push them to the ground, you take the appropriate action, because if you don't, one of your kids could be ultimately a threat. And it may be one of the hardest decisions you're going to make in your life. But one of the things I always tried to do in teaching was to have people understand that life is a training session. When you go to the bank every day, when you go to the movies, when you go into the supermarket, you walk in, you scan quickly, everybody looks okay, nobody's looking suspicious. You walk around, you're always looking, something happens, what am I going to do? Okay, if I'm alone, do I have a phone? Do I have a weapon? Am I going to engage? If somebody comes in shooting to hold up, if something happens in another part of the store, if you don't think about those things, and what I say to the kids a lot is, and the same thing I learned in the military, the last thing you want to do is think about an immediate action drill or a contingency that you've never thought about before in the middle of a very serious situation. So use life every day to train yourself into how to think. And it was the same stuff we used to do in Special Forces for different missions. We learned about a near ambush. We learned about a fire ambush. If certain things happen, these are the actions I take. And on a special operations team, other than like you see in the movies, you don't stop and ask your sergeant or your commander, hey, should I do this? No, they expect you to take the action. And it's just the same on a SWAT team. You know, you're moving, you're clearing, you see a threat. There's a way you engage that threat depending on the level of threat you see and the force continuum that you're able to use. But you have to be very comfortable to be able to make those decisions. So as you get more experience, and we put people, as you know, in the live firehouse, in the shootouts, and now we can do it all digitally too, multiple threats, multiple things, and you start to be able to compartmentalize all of these scenarios so that when and if you get into a high-risk situation like that, you've at least thought about something like this all the time. And that's the best thing you can do to mitigate your injury and the injury of the public that you have the privilege to serve. Always, if you ever think you know it all, if you're ever complacent, if you ever think you've shot enough already, you never have shot enough. You got, you know, as much as you can, you go to the range, you go through scenarios, you go through the live firehouse. And I used to do it with my teammates. We mess with each other on purpose. Put in the old days, in the old shoot houses, put the targets up, the picture of the nun, the guy with the gun, this one. Put them in different positions and even get to which target would you take out first? Who's the most lethal threat? All of those things. And how do you engage those threats without killing the nun or the teacher or the baby? You know, and we would purposely get more difficult scenarios so that when and if we ever encounter that, it's not going to be something we haven't seen or thought about before. So, you know, so in all of those situations I've been involved in, whether it was in combat or whether it was shootings as a civilian in the law enforcement, there's never a pause. It's just a switch flips. You got an algorithm. You got to move. If cover and concealment is right, it's okay. If it's not, you engage immediately. How do you engage? What shots do you take? As you know, I got to stop the threat, okay? I'm going to put two center punch. If he's still moving, he gets one in the head. That's it, all right? And in a lot of places, they teach you, you put it there anyway. Why take a chance, okay? If you've decided this rises to the level of lethal threat because of what you've been exposed to and your fear for your life or the fear of others, then you're authorized to use a lethal threat. Unlike TV, where you shoot guns out of people's hands or wing them, no, I have to stop the threat. Because if I don't stop the threat and he gets me, he or she are going to get other people as well. So it's a mindset of a warrior that you have to have, and you just have to hone it. Now, you want to be the nice dad. You want to be the good husband. All of those things. And you don't, you know, it's not like being a crazy man. But you have to have a compartment there where the switch gets thrown when something happens as an operator, that you know immediately what you have to do to protect yourself and protect others. And even if you're injured, so what? Game ain't over yet, okay? It's when this is over, I may be limping or bleeding, but I'm going to go home. He ain't going home, or she ain't going home, if they precipitated it. And, you know, and that's kind of the mindset. So whether in the military we teach it, you stay in the fight, you never give up. The firefight is not over until all the threat is eliminated, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And the higher order thinkers, of course, big firefight, military, you know, it's not about you, it's about your team, too. How am I protecting my buddy? And as you know, in the teams, there isn't one of us who wouldn't step in front of the round for our battle buddy. You know, then that's just the way it is. That's the price you pay for being an operator at that level.
Dr. Carmona speaks to his faith and how he uses it to display respect for everyone he encounters.
I've kind of been a, you know, my mother was a very strong Catholic, made us go to catechism. We're very poor, but, you know, she always wanted us to go to church and pray and go to catechism. I had a different kind of faith. I mean, I believe in God, but I didn't believe I had to go to church. And I think that I always used to rationalize that God is going to judge me on the person I am. Am I a good person? Do I have good values? Do I care for others? And if I conduct myself in that way, then I believe that, you know, whichever God you believe in or whatever religion you're in, then all of the reasonable religions, if you will, and following, that's what it's about, you know. Be a good person, care for others, you know, raise your family. And so that's kind of where I am. I'm not an overly spiritual person, but I certainly believe in spirituality and believe in God. And I also recognize many religions, not just one. You know, I believe that Jews and Christians and Muslims and, you know, are good people. But on the other hand, atheists, it's not necessarily they're bad, because as you know, as a cop or as a doc, I take care of Jews and Christians, Muslims, or atheists, okay? And if you're a bad guy, I don't care what religion you are, you get arrested, all right? So I think we have to have an open mind that, you know, faith comes in all sizes and different ways, and others, and except for those who use faith as an extreme method to do illegal things, okay, terrorism and things like that, then, you know, you accept the fact that some people may worship another god, and that's okay. But it's more important to me of what are the values that you live by, okay, as a member of a society that I share with you.
Dr. Carmona continues to follow the code and creed instilled in him by the military.
And the other side is, I think, just the, you know, that operator creed, that you realize that you, for a finite time in life, you're given this extraordinary opportunity to do missions, both military and in police, that most people watch on TV and they think they can do it pretty easy. But, you know, how many people really get to put their life on the line and do something that is really tremendous, to save the lives of others, to make communities safer, to carry out a military mission? You know, it's all the same stuff, but it's a lot. It's training, it's commitment, it's earning the right to be on an elite team where every one of your team members is not afraid to know that they're going to go before you or behind you through the door to solve whatever the problem is. That they know you have earned the right to be there. It has nothing to do with rank. It has nothing to do with your education. It is, have you earned the right to be called an operator to take on this mission? And do your peers see you as an equal, and they're willing to assign you very high-risk parts of that operation because they know they can depend on you? It is a treasure. It's a gift. It's earned, and it's something you miss when you can't do it anymore, because you remember all of those times that you shared that battle buddy experience again, whether civilian or whether military. And so, still today, all of my best friends are operators from Army Special Forces, SEAL team guys that I work with, PJs, others who we've shared that experience. And then on the police side, the SWAT guys, my team, but all of the other guys that I work with, the LAPD guys, the SWAT guys, and ESU from New York, guys that I've interacted with over the years in training and teaching and stuff, that I respect what they have accomplished as well. You know, so it's kind of a brotherhood, you know. And when we come together, like at the National Tactical Officer Association or at the Special Operations Association, which are kind of the fraternities, if you will, where the guys get together. And more and more now, women get together. And we get to, you know, hang out with each other, share experiences, learn from each other's experiences. But going home and knowing how proud I am to have earned the right to be part of this profession at the highest levels in these operator teams to do the things that we get to do. It is a privilege. It is a privilege. And everybody thinks they can do it until they try.
For a man who has led such an extraordinary life, I asked if he had a greatest achievement or a greatest regret.
Greatest achievement. I guess there's a couple of things. Marrying well above my station, okay? A woman who took care of me my whole life and probably deserved a whole lot better than what she got from me because I was absent so much. I would say for sure. A regret. I was always a good father and a good husband, but I could have been better because I was gone a lot. So that's a regret. You regret the birthday parties you missed, the call-outs when something happened, the deployments, you know, military, when you missed somebody's wedding, somebody's birthday, somebody's funeral. I don't dwell on them, but, you know, just a little bit of sadness there that you'd like to have been present. Like Diane used to say to me, my wife, I go to the park on some evening with the kids when they were young. Or, you know, we go to a movie and all of the other families are sitting there with their daddy. But my kid's daddy is jumping out of a plane or going on a mission someplace or doing a SWAT call. And she says, you know, you've been doing this all your life. And I understand, you know, she was always very supportive. But what you forget is that they vicariously live all those experiences with us. There's only so many times somebody could come to the door and say, ma'am, would you come with us? Your husband's been injured. You know, your husband's been shot. You know, and she went through that a number of times. You know, and although we dismiss it and our goal is, okay, when can I get back in training? You know, I'm going to go to the gym tomorrow and work out. They're suffering. They're suffering. And the kids are suffering. Because they see it in the papers, you know, SWAT guy gets shot, Special Forces guy does this, whatever it happens to be. And you forget that we are so insulated and we have that thick skin. And if we were, you know, bachelors living alone, cool. Team members will come and help you, you know. But you got a family at home that's just worried. And they are going through this as if they are getting shot at themselves. And, you know, I don't want to wake up and find out you ain't coming home one day. So those were kind of the regrets. And I guess I, as I got older, I was more sensitive to how the average person, my family, experienced this versus me just looking at it as it's the cost of doing business as an operator, you know? And so over time, I've come to be more sensitive to the anxiety, the pain, the stress that it causes others who care about you. And I know you've lived it too in your life, Jay. So those are kind of more the regrets and the sadness. My happiness is I can't believe I have had so many opportunities in my life. None of my kids on my block or my brothers and sister, none of us ever got out of high school. You know, I'm a high school graduate, high school dropout, going in the Army at 17 with no skills, no education. You know, and I think how fortunate I was to be in this country, to be able to appreciate my fullest potential, where I couldn't have done this in most other countries. You know, as long as you work hard, you're willing to get up a little earlier, stay up a little later, sweat a little bit more. You know, and you can keep achieving because the opportunities are there. But as you know, the only easy day was yesterday. And if it was easy, everybody'd be doing it. And so I always think back and kind of, it's almost like you got to pinch yourself that, wow, it's been quite a journey and being able to do all the things I love to do, exceeding my mother's expectations, she just wanted to go to a high school graduation. None of the kids ever got out of high school. My brother Phil followed me in Special Forces 30 years, and retired Sergeant Major. You know, numerous combat tours all over the world, years and years, and proud of him. You know, and my sister died early from medical problems. My other brother stayed on the street, and you know, he got a night school diploma, but worked hard, and eventually worked in the union and worked in food service. And, you know, he's retired, and he did okay. So the, you know, the Carmona boys and did okay. My young sister, who passed away a few years ago, she struggled through life, but she eventually did okay. But you know, it's all too attributed to the opportunities that you can get in America that you can't get anyplace else. And again, starting with being just an old grunt soldier and working my way up, and understanding duty and honor and country, the great, you know, what it is to be a citizen, democracy, how do we protect it, you know, all of those things, and never realizing until years later the foundation that the military gave me to be able to take on life and look at everything. I'll give you one last anecdote, which was a funny one. Years after I was in the military, I'm the SWAT team leader, and the guys would come up to the house here all the time, and you know, they were like my kids' uncles. They knew everybody. And one day my daughter had her girlfriends over. She was in high school then. She had her daughters over. She had her friends over. And one of the girls was, I heard her asking my daughter, you think I could talk to your dad and ask him about career advice? She goes, don't ask him about career advice, because I know what he's going to say to you. He's going to ask you about your mission, you know? And so a little later, the lady, young lady comes over to me and said, Dr. Carmona, you know, what about... And I said, well, ma'am, I said, so what is your mission? What is it you want to accomplish? I said, what are the resources you have? What's your timeline? What are the deliverables? And Carolyn's like, my daughter's looking, and she's going, oh, there he goes again, you know, like this. And so years later, now I have grandkids. My daughter, as you know, is married to a federal agent who's an operator. And my wife said she made the mistake also. So my daughter is admonishing my grandson for something silly that little kids do. You should have done this, you should have done that, and missed homework assignment or something. And she goes, what was your mission on this particular assignment? And I start to open my mouth, and she looks at me and she says, don't you say a word, you know? Because the kids grew up emulating that too. Stay focused, what's your mission, you know? And so I'm pretty lucky. If it all ends tomorrow, you know, I've had a great ride, exceeded any expectation that I could have possibly had, and I still get to, you know, play at my age and educate the youngsters and still be part of the department, stay connected with my colleagues in the military. You know, I've had all these, you know, as vice chair of the Defense Policy Board, Health Policy Board, and you know, so it's nice to still be in the game and have evolved to be a thought leader, a mentor, and a friend to the younger operators now. And that's another gift you get, as you know, that you can give them some counseling, you can help out on things.
Dr. Carmona encourages us to find a purpose and to use whatever skills we have to lead, elevate, and improve the lives of others.
To thine own self be true. Figure out what it is, who you are, what your strengths are, what you want to do. Stay focused on whatever that mission is. Be good and kind to others. Reach out. Share whatever wealth you have, and I don't mean dollar wealth, but whatever wealth you have. Make the world a better place in everything you do. Where you see opportunity to help others, reach out. Where you see people struggling, like for us, whether it's law enforcement or military, and they're working hard, that's a teachable moment. That's not a moment to embarrass somebody, but it's an opportunity to educate some young student, whether it's law enforcement or military, anything else, you know, to be able to put an arm around them and say, look, when I was your age, I did something even worse than that. Let me tell you. So let me tell you how you might want to think about this. So I think it's about really truly being a mentor. It's understanding what it is to be a leader. A leader is responsible for the destiny of others. Even if you're a squad leader with just a couple of soldiers, a few soldiers in your squad, or you're a company commander, or you become Surgeon General of the United States. The mission doesn't change as far as leadership. You are responsible for the destiny of others. The only difference is your span and scope of authority has just changed. You have command of people all over the world as opposed to a little squad or as a SWAT team leader. You still are responsible for those people. And as a leader, part of your responsibilities are to be a mentor. that is to be able to educate those in the pipeline behind you, and making sure that if the proverbial bus takes you out, there is always somebody ready to take your position. That's the leader's responsibility. To be a steward of your brand, Special Forces, SWAT, and understand that anything you do in the 24-hour day is going to reflect on your team. So as I was told as a young sergeant entering Special Forces by the commander, not me, but the team that was being brought in, just remember this. Tonight, if you go out and get in a barroom brawl downtown Fayetteville, North Carolina, and you may win the brawl, or you get in a fight and hit your girlfriend or your wife, the headline tomorrow will not be drunken soldier beats up somebody or is in a brawl. It will be Green Beret gets in a fight. And if you do that, you besmirch our image. You will never be in this unit. And I remember the commander saying, there is no need to speak to anybody. We'll decide on an Article 15 or 31. Your only mission will be to turn in your equipment because you will never be an operator again. I'll tell you right up front. And I used to give the same message to my SWAT guys. And when we'd have a couple of days away for planning, and I'd say, you have to understand that we are the last resort for solving complex law enforcement problems. And most of the time we do it by outsmarting the bad guy. As opposed to TV, where there's always a gunfight, we pride ourselves on being able to outsmart the bad guy and never have to use lethal force. And in the hundreds and hundreds of missions, probably thousands now, that I've been on in civilian and coupled with the military, which is different, most of the time you outsmart the bad guy because you're a better thinker. You're physically able to do more. So the idea there is understanding the responsibility of the leader, of the mentor, of the brand that you own, that you want to be seen as the consummate professional. You want people to wonder how you do it, but it's very unlike TV. This is not a Rambo event, okay? Because most of the operators I know live below the radar, do tremendous things to benefit their community or the nation, and nobody ever knows that they did. So be humble. Be humble. Be the best you can be. And I think the last thing I would tell you is the day that you feel you know everything and you feel complacent is the day that you should hang up being an operator or being a police officer. You should get up every day, whether it's in the military, special operations, or police, and have a sense of urgency that what don't I know that I need to learn today so I can be a better operator. And that'll guide you best through life. And then you'll come to a point in your life where things start hurting too much, getting out of bed becomes a risk factor, and you realize that it's a young man's game. And that's okay, because then you can move on to be a senior person and help to educate those behind you. It's ironic that you're interviewing me now, Jay, that we've been friends for 30-something years from when you were a rookie. You know, I remember the star University of Arizona football player at end who probably could have played pro ball but decided to be a federal agent. And like me, as a rookie, gets in a shootout in his first mission, you know, and then gets sent to Chicago because he was going to be safe there, and he gets even more hell in Chicago. So it's like, and then of course all the undercover work you did over the years and the great things you did, you've had, I would say, an extraordinary life as well. We know a little different than mine, but nevertheless extraordinary, doing some things that most people only get to read about or watch in a movie, and you're still here. And the beauty of it is you're retired, and now where you're spending your time, you're trying to educate and train young athletes on a high school football team. That's fantastic.
Copland is produced for those courageous men and women whose alarm clock goes off every day. They put their feet on the ground, buckle on gear, and kiss their families goodbye with no guarantee they will ever come home. They go willingly, facing predators and violence on behalf of good and innocent people who simply want to live safe, peaceful lives. Thank you for listening. God bless and go be amazing.